You're listening to a recording of the Open Society Foundations, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at soros.org.
Good evening. I'm Arye Nair. I'm president of the Open Society Foundations. And it's my great pleasure this evening to introduce my longtime colleague and friend, Juan Mendez, in connection with the publication of his book, Taking a Stand, The Evolution of Human Rights. Juan Mendez is the person who has done just about everything in the field of international human rights. He has been a leading figure at important non-governmental organizations, at Human Rights Watch, where he directed the Americas division, and subsequently served as a general counsel at the Inter-American Institute for Human Rights, where he was the executive director, at the International Center for Transitional Justice, where he served as president. He has served in a variety of intergovernmental positions in the human rights field, as president of the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights of the Organization of American States, as the special advisor on the prevention of genocide for the United Nations, currently as the United Nations rapporteur on torture. He has litigated to promote human rights as counsel in the first significant case of the Inter-American Court on Human Rights, and still one of the most important cases in the history of that institution. He has conducted investigations of human rights abuses in many countries, and he also has been a victim of human rights abuse as a detainee and as a victim of torture. So Juan is going to speak for a little bit about the book. Then I will ask a question or two, and then we will open it up to others here to ask questions and enter into a conversation with Juan. So Juan, welcome.
Thank you. It's a real pleasure to be here. I want to thank the Open Society Institute for holding my first book launch. But I also want to thank all of you for being here. And most especially, I want to thank Arye not only for his very kind words of introduction, but for the very beautiful blurb that he wrote for my book. And there are so many other things for which I should thank Arye, but you'll read them in the book. So I do want to say a little bit about what the book is about. The subtitle, The Evolution of Human Rights, reflects the many changes that have happened in the last 30 years or so in the human rights movement. It's been a very important evolution in the effectiveness with which human rights are defended now around the world. And I have been very fortunate to be a part of that evolution, of that growth of the human rights movement. As you can see, my work in human rights started badly, but I have to say that after that, everything has been, I've been very, very, very fortunate to be present there when so many things were happening, with so many changes were going on, and have been a part of the process by which the human rights movement has become what it is today. I think the book also is a recognition of my profound debt to many people, and some of you are present here, and I don't you know, want to embarrass you by saying that you're here. But I do want to remember especially Emilio Mignone, the Argentine human rights leader, father of a disappeared daughter, who turned that grief into such great advocacy for human rights, and who more or less shaped the ideas that the human rights movement worldwide actually went on to champion in terms of what societies owe to victims of human rights abuses and to their families, especially when a country does a transition from dictatorship to democracy or from conflict to peace. I also owe a great debt to Ari in terms of understanding how monitoring on the ground is done and should be done, especially on conditions of danger danger not only to investigators but and more importantly to the victims that we that we interview, and especially the way Human Rights Watch did its work in the Central American wars was a great learning experience for me, and having Arie, you know, at every step of the way making decisions about how we should do that work was very very forming for me, and of course on transitional justice the same. I mean, I really owe to Arie a big debt in understanding how human rights organizations should take stands supporting the victims' right to know, the victims' right to justice, the victims' rights to reparations, and also to the victims' participation in institutional reform so that we prevent mass atrocities from happening again. The same with respect to the application of the laws of war or international humanitarian law to situations of armed conflict, where Ari will remember that we heard how to do it, among others, from Ted Meron and from Robert Goldman. As I said, there will be many other people that I need to acknowledge, but even the book is not enough to acknowledge all the people that have work with me and have taught me and have from whom I have learned lessons. The book is about what happened to me, but also about what I was fortunate to do professionally. And I tried to organize it, listing 10 or 12, I think they are, major issues of human rights. And I chose them. They're not all the areas where I work, but they are the areas where I think my personal experience, both as a victim, but also as a professional human rights worker, probably adds a little value to what the human rights movement needs to know. There are also areas that are very current, and you will see also that the book deals a little bit with choices that one has to make in different moments of one's life, especially when I was still in Argentina and during the years of the conflict there and the military dictatorship there. And there are choices that maybe I would make differently now, and I would make differently precisely because I have learned so much about. I have learned how to value human dignity, and particularly how to uphold the universality of the principles that human rights are organized around. Nevertheless, even those experiences were formative for me and important. And it's difficult to say how much what happened to me and what I did professionally in later years are intertwined, and how they influence each other, or rather how my professional life is influenced by what happened to me earlier on in my life. I really don't know exactly the answer. Maybe the book gives some light onto it. But when I became the special rapporteur on torture, I more or less instinctively said that I wanted to have a victim-centered approach to the work of the rapporteurship. And the problem is then trying to determine what does that mean. And it's not easy, but I have, and I continue to insist, in states having to allow victims to participate in every aspect of the obligations of the state to prevent and to punish the crime of torture. For example, by allowing victim participation in the trials against the perpetrators, but also consulting the victims in designing reparations programs. I think this victim-centered approach may improve the way in which we think about what states owe to the victims of torture, but perhaps also of other serious and widespread human rights violations. I think I hope that the book will offer some ideas that may be helpful to the in the present day to the human rights movement. The human rights movement has many advantages now that have been built over the years. One of them is the unprecedented broadening of the circle of supporters for human rights that we have everywhere. The movement is now much more diverse and much more rich because of that. It includes people from different cultures and some working in dangerous situations and some working across borders and in international fora. The movement has achieved a degree of access to decision makers that we couldn't have dreamed of having 30 years ago. it's become truly universal in the presence that the human rights movement has all over the world, but also in the composition of its membership. And it's no longer possible to talk of the human rights movement as organizations based in London or New York anymore, because even those large organizations to which I'm so proud to have been affiliated with, they are all over the world now, and they're no longer either London-based or New York-based alone. The movement has incorporated many more professional experts from different walks of life and from different expertise, and is now much more able to harness all that talent and all those skills in a way that also, I think, was not as possible. We couldn't be as welcoming 30 years ago as we are today of people coming and supporting human rights from very different professional and scientific perspectives. And the movement has become much more professionalized and therefore much more effective as well. But I think the movement faces many challenges, and the challenges are obviously that human rights violations don't end. Unfortunately, they reproduce themselves and they are recurring, and in some areas, like in torture, we have gone backwards. Backwards especially in the level of tolerance that societies have developed for torture. It's not irreversible, but we have a lot to do to work in persuading societies that not only that torture doesn't work and that it's immoral and it's and illegal, but also that engaging it and even tolerating it, put societies down a path where it's very difficult to come back from, and maintain confidence in institutions and confidence in the democratic process. So I hope the book will help reflect some of these ideas from the perspective of how far we have come, but also understanding that there's still so much more to do. I hope you will read it critically and tell me whether I've achieved my goal of trying to make a contribution to the understanding of the human rights movement, its trajectory in the last 30 years, and where we should be going from now on. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I should say that in asking this question, I didn't give Juan any advance notice, so he will have to respond spontaneously to it. But Juan, having done so many things in the human rights field, I wonder if you would cite an example of something that particularly gave you satisfaction, and on the other hand, an example of something which left you feeling particularly frustrated. Because I think that that might indicate some of the pleasures, but also some of the difficulties of doing the sort of work that you have done for so long.
And there's no running away from the question is not an option here. So
let me give you a suggestion even. You know, observing your work at Human Rights Watch, I might have put your efforts in Honduras as among those that particularly gave you satisfaction. Is that a fair reading?
Yes, and thanks for the tip, so I don't forget. That is one, because I think in Honduras, when Human Rights Watch, America's Watch at that time, started looking into the matter, the practice of disappearances was ongoing, and it was only starting, and it could have reached very high levels. Honduras was, of course, not a theater of the Central American Wars, but it was very much used by all sides to the different conflicts in many perverse ways, I think the ability to demonstrate that disappearances were happening and that they were very similar to the Argentine method, as we called it in our first report, probably helped at least contain the damage at the time. I have to say that a lot of the merit goes to the families of the disappeared. They were very brave. They were very courageous. They were also very detailed, and they were not in any way trying to score political points against anybody. They just wanted to know where their loved ones were, and they reached out to us to see if we could help them. And the same relatives of the victims then helped us build the case that Aria mentioned before, Velázquez Rodríguez versus Honduras. That was the first case by the Inter-American Court on Human Rights, and that it has, you know, it has a life of its own. Now, what is it, almost 30 years later, 20-some years later, it's still very widely quoted for the many different principles that the court established there as to what governments owe to victims. I when you asked me the question, I was thinking of an even earlier case that I think I mentioned in my book, but that I want to mention here as well. Sylvia and I had a very good friend called Rolando Jekyll in Argentina, and he was arrested at the very end of the earlier military dictatorship around 1971 or so, 72. And I represented him, and he had been tortured together with several others, but he didn't say a word. And because of that, not so much because of any professional expertise on my part, but he was released. He was not. He was released after a few days, and I still remember very distinctly going to tell his mother that he was going to be released when she was actually expecting a long and difficult prison term. and how her face illuminated when I told her that she was coming out justified all the years of cracking books to study law, becoming a lawyer, etc. I have to say, however, that that's also a case of disappointment, because unfortunately years later, during the dictatorship, the 1976 dictatorship, Rolando became one of the disappeared. And his case is one in which there's going to be a conviction in the next week. It's going to be read against several naval officers who run the infamous torture and disappearance center called ESMA in the city of Buenos Aires.
How about on the frustration side? I mean, you've held these positions with the UN and the Organization of American States, and these are positions of some authority. What are the frustrations that you've encountered?
Well, at the OAS, the fact that I was denied a second term, I really liked what I was doing, but I conducted the only presided over the only mission to Venezuela that the OAS has ever had, and it happened a month after the failed attempted coup against Chavez, and we defended the constitutional order, and we publicly criticized the coup, but we also found fault with several things that Chavez was doing right after being returned to power, and they never forgave those things. They Venezuela campaigned very heavily against my re-election, and they kind of had it easy because they had very good relations with all the English-speaking Caribbean nations that retained the death penalty, and I had worked in many cases on death penalty cases against several of those countries. And so
Venezuela also gave a 40% discount on oil to the Caribbean countries, partly as a way to have a large number of votes in the Organization of American States.
Right. So it was an uphill battle to be reelected anyway. And with respect to the United Nations, I was fascinated by my job as the Special Advisor on the Prevention of Genocide. But I've always said that that's the hardest job that I have ever had to do. It was very difficult to persuade members of the Security Council, particularly the permanent members, to separate out the question of the possibility of genocide from all other geopolitical and other considerations. And it was also particularly disappointing because when the job was created, it was at the behest and the request of the Security Council. So one had hoped that the job would allow a close relationship with the Security Council. Unfortunately, that didn't happen. And it didn't happen for a variety of reasons, but mostly because the permanent members, and I mean all five of them, well, with perhaps the exception on genocide of Britain and France, they just don't want to hear about having to put a stop to genocide. And so, U.S. Ambassador John Bolton actually denied me the possibility of briefing the Security Council after I returned from my second trip to Darfur, even defeating his own position. But it was very disappointing because that marked the kind of limits of the possibility of doing serious prevention of genocide from the Secretariat of the UN and from this position supposedly close to the Security Council.
Let me open it up to others here. So if you go to a microphone, if you would introduce yourself, but be aware that you're being recorded. Okay. as you do so.
Thank you, Aria. Joanna Weschler with Security Council Report. Juan, you actually already answered part of my question. a question I was planning to ask you, but I would like to ask you about your experience with the UN, and the experience with the political side of the UN has been very frustrating, and you just told us why. Could you talk about how it compares to being a rapporteur based in the traditional UN human rights machinery, and whether or not this is enough, or whether there are some missing links in the system that you would like to see created?
Well, I think the rapporteurships, the special procedures, as they are called, have one huge advantage, and that is that you don't, you're not limited by a mandate that is treaty-based and therefore is limited to the countries that have signed and ratified the treaty. So theoretically, you have jurisdiction, quote unquote, over 193-194 countries. Practically, the downside of that is, of course, that it's very clear that what special procedures do is not binding, and therefore you really have to exert yourself to have a lot of power of persuasion, because countries don't want to recognize that they have certain obligations. But I think the special rapporteurship on torture has a big advantage also, in that it's been around 26 years or so, and it has quite a trajectory. It has been occupied before me by four very distinguished European jurists, and they have blazed a trail that allows me to work on their behalf. And in that same vein, I mean. At the same time, that also creates a lot of expectations. So the rapporteurship on torture is by far the most demanding and the most requested and in demand of all the special procedures. But again, I like what I'm doing, and it's very challenging to try to make it work, to make it effective. Your question is whether there are gaps that the United Nations or some body within the United Nations should be able to close. I'm sure there are, but I think we're probably going in the opposite direction. The Human Rights Council continues to create special procedures, and the member states continue to, withdraw support for all that we do. So we're doing a lot more with a lot less all the time, including the fact that all of us special rapporteurs and working groups are volunteers, and we are not blessed with a whole lot of resources to do our work or support from staff. Beyond that, of course, there's gaps in the protection. There's a new convention on disappearances that I hope will close one of the important gaps. But I think we still, don't know how to deal with certain areas of human rights protection, especially persons with certain vulnerabilities, like indigenous peoples, like gender-based violence against women. There's a lot of attention to those issues. Whether we have actually found the way to deal with them effectively, is a different matter. I don't want to sound overly pessimistic. I'm just mentioning them as challenges where we need to focus our attention on our creativity.
I think a lot of people here know quite a lot about your efforts, but you've done something quite recently as special rapporteur on torture, and I'd love to hear you talk a little bit about it. You issued a report identifying solitary confinement as a form of torture, and I wish you would say something on that.
Sure. The special rapporteurs can, from time to time, issue thematic reports, not reports that are based on empirical evidence or judgments about the conduct of certain states, but themes within our mandate that need to be explored further. And I chose my first one to the General Assembly to be about solitary confinement, because I sense, and we have some empirical evidence, but of course it's not a complete survey, that solitary confinement is growing around the world. And it's growing in its use, but also in diversity, because it's used for many different purposes now, some legitimate and some not so legitimate. And the other problem is that solitary confinement doesn't have very clear standards. International law does prohibit pain and suffering that amounts to torture or to cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment, but it doesn't say when that happens. And on solitary confinement, there are no particular rules other than that it cannot reach that kind of level of pain and suffering. And so what I try to do in my report is, in addition to generating, first acknowledging that that my proposals are all de lege ferenda, as they say in law, meaning, you know, proposals to the international community, not something that already is binding on them. And I propose a complete ban on prolonged or indefinite solitary confinement, and a complete ban on using it against juveniles or against people with mental disabilities. And then regulating the use in other situations, like, for example, when it is legitimate to use it, for example, as within prison breaches, to deal with breaches of prison discipline, to deal with the possibility in incommunicado detention, for example, when it's likely that communication with the outside world will result in obstruction of criminal investigations, but then regulate it so that it's not prolonged or indefinite, and that it's also surrounded by certain safeguards, like, you know, being ordered only by a judge and supervised daily by a judge, to have medical attention on a regular basis, to be able to challenge the decision, and to make sure that if it is done for a legitimate purpose. And I think, for example, solitary confinement for purposes of punishment as an add-on to a prison sentence should be banned. I mean, there's no need to inflict severe pain when you already have a prison sentence. I also feel that in pretrial detention, solitary confinement that goes beyond a very limited time is a violation of the presumption of innocence, because people are being punished in advance of being declared guilty or innocent. The report is in the webpage of the Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights, and I think it's contentious, because it comes up with some ideas that states will not easily accept, but that was the purpose. And I'm glad that you mention it, and I'm also glad that after I wrote it, I learned from Arie that Charles Dickens, way back in the 19th century, had already called solitary confinement torture. So I can use that in the future if we continue to campaign on this. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you very much. My name is Lydia. I'm from Uganda. I'm a visiting scholar under the Institute of the Study of Human Rights. I would like to thank Open Society Foundation for bringing me to this place to build my capacity. In my community, this is a rural woman whose husband was tortured to death, and she does not remember when. Of course, those are the questions they ask from police and other institutions. So we help her to take the case under the organization, but they need a lot of money moving up and down, looking for evidence, witness, and you have to transport them. So at the end of it all, we did not succeed because we could not do anything. The organization is young. We don't have funders yet. We are just doing work on voluntary. So the husband was tortured to death on allegation that he was hiding a gun. So during the search, the man was asked, where is the gun? And he didn't have the gun. He was saying, I don't have any gun. And he was beaten, broken, until he died. So we took the woman to human rights and we're asking her, they were asking her, do you remember the date? She can't remember because she's a rural woman. She didn't even record anywhere. And then do you have a post-mortem to show evidence that your husband truly died because of torture? So at the end of it, we didn't get any access to justice. So I was asking that, where is the universality of human rights in this kind of issue, especially when you look at the rural women whose husbands are tortured to death and they are widowed, they have nothing.
Thank you. Well, I encourage you to send me the description of the case and see if in the rapporteurship we can do something to get the government to respond the way it ought to respond. Fortunately, we don't have limitations on which country to work on, how old the case is, etc. So if you send me a note, maybe I can do something.
My name is Nadia Bazan. I work for a women's organization in Colombia. And given your analysis on the context, I would like to hear your perspective of the current situation in Latin America, in countries like Mexico or Guatemala, Colombia, and others, where there is a rising of violence, and there is a lot of disappearances and torture, not doing by the state, but these shadow powers. So what's your analysis of this situation, and what can be done in your perspective?
Well, I mean, the human rights situation in the continent is dire. There's no question about it. At the same time, Latin America has developed tools to deal with human rights violations that are very effective and work very well within the constraints that every country has. I think the civil society in Latin America and especially, obviously, could be better, but especially if you compare it with the rest of the world, has become very, very sophisticated and creative, and manages to, you know, deal with situations that are always changing in very effective ways. But that doesn't mean that they don't need help, or that they. You know, we can simply rely on the fact that now Latin America is a region of democratic governments, and therefore we don't need to worry about it. I think we need to recognize that the trend towards democracy in Latin America, if it has not ended all the possible violations of human rights, in fact, if anything, new violations of human rights have risen to the surface. It does give us a much better setting in which to deal with those violations, not only because there's a rich civil society, but also because, you know, in varying degrees, institutions are beginning to work. I necessarily have to compare with my time when I was 20, 25, 30, and most of the governments in Latin America were military dictatorships. So this is not to be triumphalistic or to think that we're now in good shape. On the contrary, I think there are new forms of violations. A friend of ours, Pepe Salaquet, has sometimes called it endemic violations, violations that are not particularly directed against a particular political enemy. But are there in society, and maybe they were kind of hidden under the dictatorships, but they have come out, and it's very hard, very difficult for us to deal with them effectively. Violence is certainly, you know, involved in all of them, and violence in many different ways. But in terms of, you know, how do we attribute to the state the violations and the violence that happens? I think we have tools, again, developed by the Inter-American System of Protection. For example, it's, you know, if a paramilitary group is doing the bidding of the government or of the certain elements within the government, like the armed forces, there's no question that the state is responsible. And even in those cases in which the violence is committed by a non-state actor, like in the cases of domestic violence against women. Again, the Velázquez-Rodríguez case gives us a wonderful analysis of the obligations of states to exert due diligence in dealing with violence, even if not committed by state actors. And so if we can make the case that the state, either deliberately or by negligence, refuses to deal systemically with a problem like domestic violence, then the state is internationally responsible. And that is something that Latin America has contributed to the human rights movement around the world.
Hi, I'm Tanya Bernath. I work independently now, but I worked with Amnesty International for many years on West Africa mostly. I just wondered what your thoughts were on economic, social, and cultural rights and how that's what part of the evolution that is for human rights now. And I don't know how, I haven't read your book, but how you might have dealt with that in your book.
I don't deal very much with it because that's one of these areas where my participation in the human rights movement has been relatively marginal. With Ari, we have a very long-standing debate. I believe that economic, social, and cultural rights are part of the human rights canon, not just because they have been incorporated into international instruments, but despite the limitations of the conventions themselves, the international covenant, especially on economic, social, and cultural rights, but also the nature itself of what we're asking the state to do when we say you have to uphold economic, social, and cultural rights, in which I think Ari has a very good argument that it's very different from what we're asking the state to do when civil and political rights are violated. But I do believe that we have achieved a consensus in the human rights movement that economic, social, and cultural rights are part of the canon, and they should be indivisible. I mean, the rights are indivisible, and we should not, you know, pitch one against the other. But other than just thinking and debating among friends about it, I have not really worked on, say, issues of justiciability of economic, social, and cultural rights, which I find fascinating. So the book doesn't really deal much with that. I think I mentioned the debates, but that's about all I do in the book.
Hi, Juan. Naomi Kikoller from the Global Center for the Responsibly Protect. I have two questions. Prior to working on R2P, I worked on behalf of three Canadians of Syrian descent who were tortured in Syria. And I also worked on the cases of Afghan detainees that were transferred by the Canadian authorities to Afghan authorities. And I was wondering if you could comment a little bit on some of the challenges and some of the kind of dual role that Western states have on the issue around torture. In the one sense, as special rapporteur, they may be very supportive of your mandate and thematically endorse the prohibition against torture, yet at the same time have been complicit in different cases in the commission of torture. So just some of the challenges around that. And then second, just very broadly, your reflections on the future around R2P and some of the kind of strategies that you think might need to be employed in the future to broaden the support that there is for R2P globally. Thank you.
Well, I think what's been very disappointing in the last few years is that Western democracies have not lived up to their obligation to investigate, prosecute, and punish every case of torture. And that's a standard that is very clear in international law, and not only as a matter of the Convention Against Torture, to which the United States, by the way, is a signatory, but also as a matter of general international law, because the prohibition on torture is jus cogens, therefore an imperative norm of international law that no state can depart from, but also the obligation to investigate, prosecute, and punish every act of torture is there. And by the way, a good reminder is that the main contribution on that point has been made by Professor Antonio Cassese, who unfortunately died only 2 days ago after making enormous contributions to bringing international human rights law and international humanitarian law and international criminal justice into the mainstream of international law as we know it today. Unfortunately, you know, major countries like the United States refuse to investigate. I hope that the civil society organizations of the United States will continue to insist on it, and that someday sooner rather than later, but someday the investigations will take place and they will be open and honest and reaching whoever they have to reach. And in that sense, you know, what has happened in Argentina and is now happening in Uruguay, what has happened in Chile and Peru, and hopefully will happen in Brazil soon, is a good lesson, because these things don't go away. The matters are not abandoned. And sometimes you have to wait until there's a good opening and a good opportunity. But the obligation to the truth and to justice and to reparations for the victims and to institutional reform, which now we associate with the words transitional justice, they just don't go away, and they will be there knocking at future governments' doors as well as present governments. In the meantime, we have to continue to insist on it, even if we're very disappointing that we don't get results immediately. With respect to responsibility to protect, I'm, you know, the adoption of the doctrine by the summit in 2005, unanimously by more than 100 heads of states who were present here in New York, came as I was beginning to work on as a special advisor on prevention of genocide, and it was a big boost to the legitimacy of what I was trying to do. I think, however, that the pushback began almost immediately, and it has not succeeded in abolishing the doctrine, but it has succeeded in slowing down and perhaps, you know, slowing down to a crawl the possibilities of putting it in practice, of implementing it, of making it a reality. In that sense, I think, however, I think that, you know, we can still rely on responsibility to protect for the obligation to come to the rescue of people like in Libya, even in Syria as well today. But it's still hard to persuade the international community in general, but particularly the most important decision makers, that the responsibility to protect means that we just cannot be indifferent to the plight of people who are threatened with genocide, crimes against humanity, or war crimes. And you know, I think we continue to debate whether responsibility to protect is just another word for humanitarian intervention, when it's clear that responsibility to protect also involves prevention. It involves many different ways of protecting people without non-consensual armed intervention. But even non-consensual armed intervention we have to keep as a last resort, because sometimes it's the only thing that's going to save lives.
Juan, let me press you a little bit on that. I don't hear responsibility to protect invoked with respect to Syria. You know, one heard it infrequently with respect to Libya. In fact, what was done probably met the standard of responsibility to protect, but the concept was not discussed often. Do you really see any significant possibility that over time the doctrine might be invoked with respect to Syria?
Well, I agree with you that responsibility to protect is not invoked specifically in the deliberations in the Security Council, which is the locus of where the decisions have to be made. And the reason is obvious, you know, that they don't want to set a precedent so that the responsibility to protect will trigger new interventions down the road. The Security Council wants to retain a lot of flexibility, and sometimes the flexibility means not acting. But by the same token, we already had the Genocide Convention and the jus cogens prohibition on genocide and the obligation to protect people from genocide in 1994, and in the genocide in Rwanda happened with the international community not intervening. Now, obviously, many of these things are a way of learning lessons from what should have happened and didn't happen. I think the doctrine as it is today is helpful in at least in generating the debate. And the fact that it's not cited doesn't mean that it doesn't undergird some of the interventions of some of the states, or is not present in the debates, perhaps not publicly, but in you know, where those debates are held. I think it's an important tool to be able to analyze the international community reactions to Libya, to Egypt, to Syria, or non-reactions, and then, you know, debate amongst all of ourselves whether responsibility to protect makes a difference or not. I think it's an important doctrinal contribution. But it's not an import. It's not a. It hasn't reached the level of a norm that we can actually pull from and say, therefore, you have to act. It'll be a while before it gets to that level. But in the meantime, I think it's helpful to have, especially because I think it overcomes some of the weaknesses that its predecessor, the doctrine of humanitarian intervention, had.
Ren. Ren Weschler, Lawrence Weschler. Two questions about the terrain of human rights right now. One, just very quickly, is from both of you. To what extent was the treatment of Gaddafi a human rights issue after his arrest?
Huge human rights issue.
Right. How so?
Well. You know, I think the transitional government in Libya has a responsibility to come clean with what happened, to investigate to wherever it leads, and to prosecute people who, you know, at least from the evidence we have so far, seem to have killed Gaddafi after surrender. Mm-hmm. Killing somebody after surrender, you know, is a red flag, and mm-hmm. you know, there may be circumstances that we don't know yet, but the worst thing that can happen is for the government of Libya to say, well, he could have been killed by his own people. I mean, those are speculative, and they sound so much like the excuses that we heard in the past about the disappeared, about you know, violations committed by military regimes, that we're off to a bad start unless the government really investigates. And I think...
I would go further that, you know, even if he didn't actually surrender, if he was hors de combat at that point, that is, if he was wounded and then in the custody of his captors, that it was a war crime to engage in his execution.
Is that, I guess the specific question I ask is, if it turns out that it was a chaotic scene, that people were, I mean, it was not a very formal military unit and so forth, and that there were just somebody who just,
what we know right now is that apparently someone shot him in
head.
And at that stage, when he was captured, injured, and ordered to combat, that was an execution.
The proper thing to do at that point is to arrest that person, in other words?
Well, investigate who did it and who helped the person do it. And it's no excuse that it was chaotic. I mean, the combatants have to behave according to the laws of war in every situation. You can't have them fighting our good fight when they do things right, but oh no, they're not ours when they commit atrocities.
And on the other extreme of things that are organized, I want to push a little bit on the economic rights and so forth. Right now at the Public, there's a remarkable performance going on by Mike Daisy, who has a piece called The Agony and the Ecstasy of Steve Jobs, where he talks about the truly horrendous conditions at these plants in China, but kind of not really in China. I mean, there are these economic places that are outside Chinese control or kind of inside Chinese, hundreds of thousands of people working under what turn out to be extraordinarily horrible conditions. And it's, by the way, not just Apple, but virtually everything we have in our pockets and so forth had the same problem. And I guess the question I have is the interlocutor of the human rights issues there China, or is it Apple Computer? And if it is Apple Computer or any of the other things, to what extent does the human rights movement have to reconfigure in this age of globalization?
Well, in terms of international responsibility, the interlocutor or the entity to hold responsible is a state where these conditions take place. And if they are under its jurisdiction, the state cannot escape responsibility. But I think the human rights movement has also developed the ability to speak truth to power, even to important economic actors that may not be institutionally responsible, but can be held morally responsible. To the extent to which they can be held legally responsible is an important open-ended question, especially in the courts of this country, because there have been some cases brought against institutions under the Alien Torch Claims Act. I mean, against business under the Alien Torch Claims Act. In the rest of the world, I think the debate is not quite as open as it is here. But I think even in the United States, the result is going to be uncertain. We cannot say that. But even if we cannot hold corporations legally responsible, I think it's very important for the human rights movement to continue and to continue creatively to find ways in which businesses are held responsible to consumers, to the public at large about how their products are made.
Just as an example on corporations being held accountable, one of the Alien Tort Claims Act cases was against Unocal with respect to forced labor in Burma. The case ultimately did not go to judgment. Unocal settled out of court. And the settlement under the arrangement that was made was confidential, but they did pay damages in that case. So it has been possible to sue corporations under the Alien Tort Claims Act successfully when something like forced labor is involved.
Do you think Human Rights Watch and places like that should be doing the suing?
Well, I think what?
Human Rights Watch, Amnesty International, and so forth should be doing that?
You know, they are not litigation organizations, and so they're not the organizations that undertake this. Sitting in the back of the room is Sandra Colliver, who previously directed the Center on Justice and Accountability, and that's an organization based in California, which litigates cases of this sort on an ongoing basis. The human rights movement has become quite specialized, and so there are institutions which particularly take on litigation of that sort, and the Center on Justice and Accountability is in the forefront of the groups dealing with that kind of issue. Yes.
Hi, Juan. Thank you very much. I'm Kate Hunt from CARE International. to carry on from the question of non-state actors that are responsible for conditions that violate human rights standards, I wondered if you would mind giving us your sense of the future for situations in armed conflict where rebel movements or very inchoate militia organizations are basically outside of the rule of law. There is no rule of law. They commit rape, they pillage, they do all sorts of things, and there isn't a corporation to bring to trial. You know, there isn't an identifiable power in some of these situations. I'm wondering how you see that, the unraveling of rule of law in many places, and how we can work on bringing perpetrators to justice in a broader sense than the one case that might get to The Hague.
Well, I was going to say precisely that now we have an instrument, the International Criminal Court, to bring bring to judgment and to justice people who commit these atrocities, as long as they are part of an organized, even a semi-organized fighting force. If they commit war crimes, and you know, it depends on, you know, on the conditions of the conflict itself, whether they are war crimes or not. Obviously, if you're referring to more generalized violence that with much less degree of organization and no clear purpose of fighting for power, the only thing that we can do is really strengthen the national state to respond to protect populations from harm and to make everybody respect the rule of law. That's in many parts of the world a very, very tall order, a very difficult task. But you know, in the current conditions of how international human rights law is applied, we really rely very much on the nation state and on trying to make it live up to its obligations under international law.
And just to add to that, you know, the various international criminal tribunals have prosecuted quite a large number of cases against individuals associated with these non-governmental abusers of human rights. The International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia has done that. The Special Court for Sierra Leone has done that. So the International Criminal Court itself has indicted those associated with such groups. So I think there is a readiness by those bodies not to limit themselves to states, but also to prosecute members of organized groups that engage in severe human rights abuses.
I mean, in the past, people would have debated whether the war conducted in northern Uganda by the Lord's Resistance Army was really an armed conflict or not, but that's no longer being debated. You know, Lord's Resistance Army, that Rush Limbaugh calls a Christian group, you know, is undoubtedly subject to the jurisdiction of the ICC.
Felipe Michelini from Uruguay. The title, it's the evolution of human rights. It seems to me, as you have talked already, that it's the evolution of your own approach to human rights and your theoretical tools to deal with these issues. My question is that maybe in Central America and in the Southern Cone, things were much more clear. Bad guy, good guys. Wasn't Colombia and Peru much more challenging realities to for your work in the 90s?
Well, I mean, the subtitle refers to the evolution of the movement, not so much to my evolution, I don't think. But I think, we confronted different challenges. I mean, we started dealing with, you know, violations committed by military dictatorships against, you know, in the pretense or with the excuse that there was some level of political violence in place, but not really an armed conflict to speak of. Then we had to move into the Central American wars, where the armed conflict was very real. It was with territorial control, population control, etc. And so the rules necessarily had to change, and the way we did our monitoring and investigation had to change as well. But in those cases, either there were dictatorial governments or the military establishment of elected governments was so much a power on its own that it wasn't all that different to try to hold those states responsible. But I think later in the 90s, Colombia and Peru present a different challenge. And if that's what you mean, the government of Fujimori, was undoubtedly elected and then re-elected several times, even after it violated the constitution of Peru. And the governments of Colombia, maintained a behavior towards its institutions more or less respectful of the rule of law, but at the same time with incredible amounts of violence and of very serious human rights violations committed by state agents and by paramilitaries who are, but for all intents and purposes, state agents as well. So, yes, it presented more of a challenge in terms of explaining ourselves and insisting on these principles. But by the 90s, we were saying, these principles apply to dictatorships, but they apply to democracies as well. And there's really no reason why we should give a pass to a government only because it's been elected. So I think that's now clearly understood. But you're absolutely right that in those times, we did face a challenge, at least in winning the hearts and minds of public opinion. Because we were told, you're criticizing a government that is legitimate, that is elected, and that is doing its best to deal with a difficult situation. And yes, there were and there are now, always people who are willing to give that pass to states. But I think the human rights movement can only insist on principle and say, we understand all that background, we understand the whole context, we even describe the context ourselves, but in the end, it's a question of principle, it's a question of responsibilities.
Hi, thank you. My name is Angela Dean. I am a graduate student at NYU, but have worked with the Genocide Intervention Network for the past few years. So I wanted to get your thoughts specifically, and both of you actually, because I know you've met with my boss, Mark Hanna, several times, from my former boss. Rebecca Hamilton just had a book come out, which I believe was funded by OSI, talking about the role of advocacy organizations in the genocide prevention movement. And so I wanted to get your thoughts on the efficacy of the advocacy movement within the United States and globally, because obviously we've seen with the Darfur movement, arguably the most robust movement against genocide historically. So what do you see the role of advocacy organizations, and how can they best position themselves here and abroad?
I have a great admiration for Rebecca Hamilton's book. It's really excellent. I participated in a debate, not a debate, but a presentation, a launch like this one done in Washington. And I think it's a great contribution to the creation of a grassroots movement in the United States to counter genocide wherever it occurs. It's also very much related to the experience of trying to help in the situation in Darfur. And that does, provide very important lessons for grassroots movements. I think the book demonstrates also that it's not just a matter of getting Washington to respond. I mean, that the prevention of genocide you know, obviously each grassroots movement has to do it in its own countries first and then project internationally. But I think Darfur, you know, we were not able to have a better international answer to Darfur, among other things, because we never really created an international movement modeled after the human rights movement, or created more specifically to generate a response, a preventive response to genocide. Nevertheless, of course, the experience of the, especially the student movement in the United States, is very relevant and very important to analyze and to look at all the challenges and difficulties and how they were overcome. And I think Rebecca's book, Rebecca Hamilton's book, is very useful in that sense.
First, on Rebecca Hamilton's book, it was not published by the Open Society Institute. She held a fellowship here, and then she published the book herself. We don't require that fellows speak the line of the Open Society Institute. They're free to say what they wish in the books that they publish. My concern with the genocide prevention effort is somewhat along the lines that that Juan expressed, and that is that it's valuable to have an effort like that underway in the United States, but the influence of the United States worldwide is declining. And it's therefore enormously important that such movements should exist in other parts of the world. At one point, I went to Cairo in part to take part in a conference on Darfur sponsored by an organization called the Cairo Institute for Human Rights. And they led an effort to develop a movement concerned with Darfur in the Arab countries. It was not immensely successful, but I thought it was extremely important to try to encourage such efforts, because I think if there had been a significant movement focused on Darfur in the Arab countries, that would have had more of an impact in terms of the policies of the government of Sudan than what might have been undertaken in the United States. I think that organizations like Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch, which are global in their efforts to protect human rights, are engaged today in significant efforts to enhance their ability to generate support for human rights internationally in all parts of the world. And I think that's one of the sort of important challenges of the human rights movement. That is, that there has to be support for human rights internationally emanating from democracies such as Brazil and India and Indonesia and South Africa, if the effort to promote human rights worldwide is to be effective. With a global effort to promote human rights globally, we can get significantly further than we're now able to get.
Sarah Weschler.
You're going to be the last person to ask a question, because we've reached the moment that we said we would end.
Okay.
Best for last.
I wanted to come back to the issue of accountability that was raised in your question a while ago, and especially because you started talking about northern Uganda. I was wondering, recently in northern Uganda, there was a, I've been living there, and there was a trial, a man named Kwayelo, who had been a commander in the LRA, came to trial. And this was hailed, basically my question is about balancing accountability, justice, with then kind of the practicalities of achieving peace, because this was hailed as a big, as big progress, and maybe Uganda was going to be able to show that it can try a case of this kind of scale of international human rights violation, da da da, and it was being reported in that way. But then people I knew who were themselves former LRA defectors were saying this is a disaster because he is eligible for amnesty under the amnesty law, and that was true. It was very arbitrary that he hadn't been granted it, and ultimately he was. And if this gets out, if this reaches the bush, that now they are taking people who should be eligible for amnesty and bringing them to trial, it's going to have a terrible impact on defection, and people are going to be afraid to come home. I was just wondering, I mean, I think, so where do you strike that balance that, yes, people need to be held accountable, people need to be brought to justice, but at the same time, thousands of people have come back from the bush because of the amnesty law, and it's weakened the LRA tremendously. And do you understand the question? Like, where does one find a kind of middle ground between that?
Well, the middle ground is the hardest to find. But I think some of these people are coming back from the bush not only because of the amnesty, but because the arrest warrants against Kony and others have really, you know, weakened and isolated the leadership of the LRA, and people are seeing the writing in the wall. Now, the problem, the ICC will only be able to deal with a few people in any conflict, those bearing the highest responsibility, and if you're lucky. So it was always premised on the necessity of the nation state to live up to its obligations to investigate, prosecute, and punish the most serious acts. Now, I think it's great that Uganda has an amnesty law, because I do think that an amnesty law, if applied correctly, and it's an amnesty for the crime of rising up in arms against the state, the crime of rebellion, the crime of sedition, it's very legitimate under international law and very necessary for peace. But it has to be applied correctly, and it has to be applied transparently. If there's any sense in which the amnesty is manipulated and given to some but not to others, then that, I think, can prove to be a disaster. I believe in the case of Uganda, obviously I don't know this particular case, but it was always the fact that the government of Uganda needed both to have the amnesty and to prosecute at least some of those people bearing great responsibility for atrocities, including of its own government, of the own armed forces. I suppose that that's not happening, but it should.
Okay. I think we could go on for quite a long time, but we won't inflict cruel and unusual punishment on you. I'm grateful to you for speaking here this evening. I heartily commend the book, and thank you all very much for coming. Goodbye.